Plenty of people sit in high school English classes quietly thinking to themselves that teachers exaggerate the value of good writing, but not the students who make it to UNLV's Boyd School of Law. There, Professor Linda Edwards teaches her students that good writing can be a matter of life and death. Certainly, it's a big factor in whether a client goes to prison or not. Linda Edwards teaches students that they shouldn't just write legal briefs that cite the relevant cases and make technical legal arguments. They also have to write briefs that tell a good story. Joining us in studio now to tell us why is Linda Edwards. Professor Edwards, welcome to KNPR.
Thank you, Dave. It's a pleasure to be here.
So these sound like words that might come from a graduate school lecture, but I want to ask if they're really true. Aren't we talking about legal appeals, where having the technical footwork in place is really, really important for cases like this. And procedural stuff is really what counts with this. So why is storytelling and that kind of a narrative so essential to your way of thinking and presenting
this? Cognitive psychology has demonstrated, and more every day, that all of us see the world through a certain sort of frame. We don't take in information neutrally and then decide what to do with it. We instead, as a matter of cognitive psychology in our brains, already have a narrative or metaphoric perspective or frame that we are working within when we take in that new information, and we interpret it in a way that makes it as consistent as possible with the narrative frame we're working with. So all of those procedural requirements that you're talking about are very important. But any time there is any kind of discretion with regard to the facts or to professional decision-making made by either a judge or a jury, it's going to be tempered, seen through one of those metaphoric or narrative frames.
So judges are humans, too.
Absolutely.
They like a good story.
They absolutely do, yes.
Mm. Well, let's talk about a specific case where you think the story was very important. It has to do with the Miranda warning. You have the right to remain silent, et cetera, et cetera. It's been on the legal landscape and law enforcement landscape for half a century now. Why is that an important part of American policing?
Well, it's an important part of American policing in two ways. Essentially, Miranda is attempting to create a balance between law enforcement as protecting Americans against danger, against bad people, and the fear, that very legitimate fear, that the government does not exert its power inappropriately against an individual citizen. So Miranda attempts to craft a balance between effective law enforcement on the one hand and on the other hand, keeping us all safe from those kinds of government abuses that can occur.
So let's back up a little bit to this story. Tell us a little bit about the story of Ernesto Miranda. What kind of man was he?
Well, Ernesto Miranda, of course, part of the problem that any lawyer has in representing a defendant with a long rap sheet is that Ernesto Miranda did not have an easy life. And in fact, by the time he was in interrogation room 2 in the police station, he had a long history of criminal offenses, and some of them were pretty serious. A young woman, an 18-year-old young woman in Phoenix, was taken into a car, driven out into the suburbs, the desert, essentially, and there was either a rape or an attempted rape. Pretty soon, Ernesto Miranda came to the attention of the police force, and there he found himself, because he had been a suspect in this other incident, he found himself being interrogated for both of these incidents in the interrogation room without any lawyer representing him and any idea that he had a right to a lawyer. Hmm. He was, in fact, an eighth grade dropout. He had only an eighth grade education. It's quite clear, in fact, he was diagnosed as a schizophrenic with a sexual preoccupation, so that he would interpret all kinds of English phrases in ways that are essentially nonsensical. And he certainly did not speak in anatomical language about body parts. And yet, in fact, strangely enough, the confession that he signed was, in fact, entirely written in language he never would have used.
And so when the police arrested him, in effect, as you said, they interrogated him for some time, they got him to incriminate himself. And as you noted, without his understanding of his right to a lawyer.
Yes, and not just incriminate himself, but actually confess. Mm-hmm. Confess to both of these crimes.
Okay, so in the aftermath of Miranda's, the confession and such, his lawyers had to, in effect, had to tell the story in a way that said, this is not right. What happened here was not right. So how did they craft that story, and how did they present it a little bit later?
Well, part of the difficulty that lawyers have in representing criminal defendants is the fact that we all have a very human tendency to believe that if someone has had a troubled life as he had, they're probably guilty. And we tend to think that in a very human way, despite the fact that our Constitution and our entire system of criminal jurisprudence tells us to believe that people are innocent until they are proven guilty. So the defendants here had to tell a story about the way government deals with individual citizens who are accused of a crime, and particularly with individual citizens who are easily suggestible, who are mentally ill, as he was, who are very uneducated and unsophisticated, and simply vulnerable to all kinds of psychological pressures. In fact, they talked about the way police manuals train interrogators to ask questions in a way that will pressure the defendant, even without any physical violence, to pressure the defendant to go ahead and confess.
Okay, so we're going to have you read from a little bit of this in a second, but in, I guess, as a summation, what was the genius in the way in which the lawyers crafted this story?
Well, the story was told, painting for us a picture that he could not possibly really have signed. These were not his words. This confession that he signed were not his words at all, but were in fact the arresting officer's words. Then we immediately hear the story of the interrogation. And I think one of the most brilliant parts about the way the facts are told here is that interrogation room two becomes, in effect, almost a character, but certainly the visual set where we see the officers, the two of them, taking this man into this room, closing the door. We cannot see what's going on in there. And 2 hours later, when he comes out, his life is essentially over. When he is finally given his court-appointed lawyer at the time that he's charged, there's nothing that lawyer can do. It's essentially a done deal.
Okay, so could you read a little bit of this legal argument for us? Maybe a paragraph or two that really illustrates how his lawyers told his story.
Okay, this is the way the fact statement ends in the brief. When this defendant went into interrogation room two, instead of having the guiding hand of counsel, he had the guiding hand of two policemen. When he came out of interrogation room two, there was no longer any point in giving him counsel. His case was over. We believe that these practices are barred by the 6th and 14th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. When Miranda walked out of interrogation room 2 on March 13, 1963, his life for all practical purposes was over. Whatever happened later was inevitable. The die had been cast in that room at that time. There was no duress, no brutality. Yet when Miranda finished his conversation with officers Cooley and Young, only the ceremonies of the law remained. In any realistic sense, his case was done. The question presented here is whether a defendant in such circumstances is entitled to be told of his right to counsel and to have a meaningful opportunity to consult counsel before the law disposes of him.
That is a portion of the legal brief written by attorney John Frank on behalf of Ernesto Miranda. It would ultimately lead to the so-called Miranda decision by the U.S. Supreme Court some 50 years ago, which established what has come to be known as the Miranda Warning. We're talking with UNLV law professor Linda Edwards. She teaches legal writing, not just grammar and punctuation, but teaching students to tell their clients' stories well, because she says it really makes a difference in winning and losing a case. Surely it did here. From your perspective, why is this excerpt you just read such a good example of legal writing as storytelling? What makes it stand out?
Well, first of all, it's visual. We can really see these officers taking this poor man into interrogation room 2 and closing the door, and then we can't see what's going on behind the door, and we wonder. So it's drama. Second of all, it is a story about governmental power and about protection of individual citizens. It's not about what this particular individual defendant has done or has not done. So it's a larger, better story.
I want to ask a favor of you. The last line, it's a very powerful line. Would you be willing to read that again?
The question presented is whether a defendant in such circumstances is entitled to be told of his right to counsel and to have a meaningful opportunity to consult counsel before the law disposes of him.
So is justice a fait accompli before he really goes to trial in a sense?
Well, first of all, we have to look at that verb, disposes of him, bringing to mind immediately the feeling that the law is essentially treating him like a piece of trash, right? This is a human life that we're talking about here. Do we want to have a criminal justice system that treats its citizens in this way, no matter what they may have done or may not have done?
So when you're talking with your students about the power of words, is this one of the readings that you present to them?
Absolutely.
I mean, it sounds like the entire summary of this hinges on, as you say, the word dispose.
Certainly, that would be a part of the larger story here of governmental power. We're talking here about the uneducated, the vulnerable, the mentally ill. We're talking about the most vulnerable members of our society.
We are talking with Linda Edwards. She is a professor at the Boyd School of Law at UNLV. She teaches legal writing, get students to tell their clients' stories well, and that it can make a big difference in winning and losing a case. There are stories about lawyers and crime that have been out there. I mean, you can find them in bookstore upon bookstore. They've always been popular. There's stories by writers like Michael Connelly, John Grisham, who himself is a lawyer. Does crime and law, do the fields of crime and law just have really good plots and stories built into them?
Well, of course that's true. What's at stake is a lot greater often. And often there is violence and there's a human seemingly propensity to watch or hear about violent stories and to root for the good ending. But in fact, there are stories in every single event that ever comes to trial. Stories mm-hmm. are everywhere.
Do you read legal thrillers?
Not thrillers, mm-hmm. because I read at night before I go to bed, and so thrillers are a little too frightening. but I definitely read murders. Murder mysteries, I read them all the time.
So can lawyers actually make these things happen, you know, that the Lincoln lawyer does or that some of John Grisham's characters do in real life? Can a good narrative actually make for a good conclusion?
Absolutely. I think these briefs are good evidence of that.
And while we're on the subject of death penalty cases, some of these cases are argued on things like the basis of mistaken identity. But in cases where the police and prosecutors have the right person, how does a legal representative craft a story that might convert the death sentence to life in prison?
Well, there are essentially three different kinds of death penalty cases, and you've alluded really to the beginning of that discussion. The first kind is an innocence case, and we have these increasingly now with the advent of DNA testing, where issue actually is, the argument is, this defendant didn't do it, right? You've got the wrong guy, okay? The second kind is a mitigation case. This defendant did what he was convicted of doing, but there are mitigating factors that would, as you say, convert the death penalty perhaps to life in prison, including life in prison without parole. The third kind is a procedural case where the defendant may or may not have done the act, and we need to create just enough doubt in the judge's mind to consider the possibility that he may not have. But the real problem here is that the procedure was unfair in one way or another. So those three kinds of death penalty cases really are, I think, briefed in some fairly different ways. Once the lawyer gets a sense of which kind of case this is going to be, then they know how to make their arguments.
Prosecutors often in death penalty cases, capital murder cases, will have things like victims, in effect, victim statements. You know, they'll bring forward members of a family of someone who's been murdered, for instance, to talk about what an awful hardship, what an awful thing this is.
Yes.
How do you, if you are representing a defendant, how do you work against something like that, where obviously the pull is purely emotional?
It is. There's such a human tendency we all have to encounter a horrific situation and just think somebody's got to pay for this. And it can become kind of convenient to punish the person who happens to be in front of us.
So how do you tell a story? How do you find the words to tell a story that can mitigate that?
It's a knee-jerk human reaction for a defense lawyer to want to try to downplay those horrific facts and exaggerate, perhaps, the mitigating facts or the facts that might indicate, perhaps, innocence. The judge is going to have a human reaction no matter how hard he or she tries not to. It's a human reaction to identify with a prosecutor and not identify quite so much with the defense lawyer because, after all, how could you possibly represent somebody like this who did something like that?
So for these lawyers, including in the future, lawyers who were your students, this is a towering obstacle to overcome.
It is. The lawyer representing a person who has been convicted of a horrible crime has got to admit to the horrific nature of the facts and has got to admit to their own personal reaction to it. Because to try to argue that these facts are not as bad as they really are means that it's simply impossible for the judge to relate to that defense lawyer. Somehow the defense lawyer has got to cross that gulf that separates the defense lawyer from the judge and somehow join the judge, essentially, in reacting to these facts. Because only once that's done will the judge listen to what the defense lawyer has to say.
You spoke of dealing with a lot of lawyers who have worked with things like death penalty cases, writing appellate briefs and such. In your experience in talking with them, learning about their world a little bit, did you ever get the sense from them that they felt at times as though they had failed because perhaps they didn't tell a compelling story in their briefs?
I think that it's every time a capital lawyer loses a case, and almost always they will attend the execution when it happens. How could you possibly not be second-guessing every single decision you ever made? It is true that the lawyer is not responsible for the client having been in that situation, but When you get to know a client over the course of many years of handling their appeals, and then ultimately they lose their life, every single lawyer that I've ever talked to in that situation has wondered, what if I had done this? What if I hadn't done that? Would it have made a difference? It's an incredibly difficult area of law to practice.
It sounds like you're kind of glad that that's not your area of specialty.
I am, but I have the greatest respect for those who do it.
Linda Edwards is a professor of law at the Boyd School of Law at UNLV. She teaches legal writing and shows students how to tell compelling and winning stories in legal briefs. Professor Edwards, thanks so much.
Thank you, Dave.